entertainment, sports, and radio's best guest list. Live from the Zone Radio Studios on Broadway on WZON Z62, WKIT HD3, and at downtownwithrichkimble.com. This is Downtown.
Hi there, and a good Sunday morning on this 13th day of May. It's the Best of Downtown, brought to you by Cross Insurance, where security meets strength. I'm Rich Kimble, here with Carrie Haskell, our look back at some terrific conversations from the previous week. We remind you, by the way, that all of our guests come your way thanks to the good folks at G&M Family Market on the corner of Route 1A and Route 46. They're open every day from 6 a.m. until 9 p.m. On the program this morning, we talk with actor, director, writer, producer, and now author Mark Duplass about his new book with his brother Jay called Like Brothers. Rachel Slade discusses her book on the sinking of the El Faro into the raging sea. Actor and comedian Jay Moore pays a visit, and we get things rolling this morning by talking with the character actor William Sanderson, who's been working in radio and television and movies for the last four decades. Memorable roles on Deadwood, True Blood, but best known for his work on Newhart as Larry, of the brothers Larry, Daryl, and Daryl. Here's our conversation from earlier this week with actor William Sanderson. You had yourself quite a journey recently. You were out in California for the Paley Center Honors, recognizing the Newhart show.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun, and Entertainment Weekly was there, and I haven't seen it, but it came out a story about the event, and my wife was with me, so it was nice to stay in Beverly Hills.
Well, for anybody who doesn't know, I want to talk a little bit about your background. You were born in Memphis, and I understand that Elvis had an impact on you in many ways, as he did so many people.
Yes, I think he sparked a dream in a lot of people. But I was around him a lot, and I happened to have finished a memoir that's in the hands of a literary agent, and I hope people get to read it. But I put a lot of my memories in there about being around him, once being in the house when he was playing the piano, which was quite a thrill for a 13-year-old kid. He was just becoming the highest entertainer in the world. I'm dating myself, but thank you for mentioning it.
Well, you studied business and law at SMU, but then made the decision to go to New York to pursue acting, eventually to California, and you got a chance to work with some legends and some heroes along the way. We were trying to think of all the Academy Award winners you've worked with, but I know a couple really stood out to you. You got a chance to meet people like Robert Mitchum and Lee Marvin. What was that experience like?
Well, Mitchum was a hero. It was actually Lee Marvin, Charles Bronson, was one of the nice breaks to get to go to Canada, and people call it on location. I called it on vacation. It was Banff, Canada, probably like some of the beauty of Maine. But it was a great thrill. Lee drank a lot, you know, but he... Can you hear me?
You sure can.
Okay, I was hearing a little static, and I hope it's not my phone. Lee knew more about cameras and when he was drinking, then a lot of people sober. And Charles Bronson was a hero since my childhood. But luckily, I got to work with some more, even much younger. But that was a good start on the West Coast.
Yeah, you did a lot of...
Can I just interject? I did get a law degree. I never took the bar. And that's when my life sort of took a wrong turn, and I moved to New York, as you said.
Well, that wrong turn has resulted in a many decades-long career. One of the first breaks was in The Onion Field, the Joseph Wambaugh story with James Woods, and then on to other television shows and movies. People certainly remember your terrific role in Blade Runner. How long did it take sitting in that makeup chair to get ready for those scenes in Blade Runner?
It took a couple of hours, and I think my wife says you can't really see it that well. I don't know, but he had Methuselah syndrome or premature aging. He was supposed to be in his 20s, but looked like he was in his 40s. But it was a big thrill to work with Harrison Ford. At that time, he was the highest paid, he was the hottest actor in the country, and just came off a Spielberg film. And so Daryl Hannah and a lot of wonderful actors in there. So I was lucky to get it. I had been playing a lot of bad guys and or heavies, whatever you call them. I should say a lot of the roles I've played over the years were sort of idiots, but he was a genius type. He worked on a genetic system, so it was fun to play. And the great director, Ridley Scott, who's a visionary.
Yeah, William, on your website in the photo gallery section, there's a wonderful photo of you playing the role of Billy the Kid in a play directed by Tommy Lee Jones. I'm assuming that was a stage-in of the authentic life of Billy the Kid?
Yeah, that's an ironic title. This was a guy that claimed he was Billy the Kid and that he never died. Great writer named Lee Blessing, an award-winning playwright. But the joy was working with Tommy Lee. I survived 6 projects with Tommy, but that was one play I did with him in between Newhart, flying back and forth. And Tommy is a great actor, and he's very bright, and it was just a real thrill. I think that's where you learn to act, is on the stage. And sometimes wish I'd have done more in New York, but I'm grateful for the apprenticeship. But it was a play and dark comedy, you know, pulp fiction type thing, but based on history. But I wasn't really Billy. I was a crazy guy that claimed he was Billy the Kid.
We're talking with William Sanderson here on Downtown. Well, then Newhart comes along, and that just blew up for everybody. Did you have any idea? Because I think you guys appeared on the second episode. Was that intended to be a long-term thing, or was it originally just a one-off appearance?
Oh, that's a good question. I just thought it was another guest star role. I put a quarter in my ear just messing around like I had done in the movie Coal Miner's Daughter. And luckily the audience applauded and laughed, and Bob Newhart eventually encouraged him to write us in as series regulars. And it was really a joy. The people, Tom Poston, Bob Newhart, Julia Duffy, Peter Scolari, but they never intended it to be but a one-time thing. They were looking for, the producer said, 3 guys with 1 brain. Heaven help them. But John Bolstad and Tony Papenfuss had a great theater background, and they made it fun for me.
And something I discovered reading up on your career a little bit, that role was originally written for a friend of yours, fellow actor Tracy Walter.
Yeah,
and then. But you discovered that later on down the road.
Yeah, he waited a couple of years. He said, I didn't want to tell you. He's a very sweet man with a great career, lives in Beverly Hills. And I said, well, did you get crazy on him in the audition? And he said, no, I didn't do anything I usually don't. I crawled under some desks. But we take a chance. Believe me, Tracy has done well with great, great credits. And I'm proud to call him my friend.
And you two have appeared in a couple of movies together as well, right?
Yeah, we did one right after Coal Miners. I feel like I'm dropping name. After that movie, I played a brother of Tracy Walter. They'd been in Huntsville Prison in Texas, and they try to molest her. And they were, but. It was fun to work with Sissy Spacek twice. I can't help myself but drop names. Can I interject a question?
Oh, please do.
Is this a Stephen King station?
It sure is. He owns our stations.
Well, I'm so flattered. I got to work on one of his, sometimes they come back based on a short story, but I even steal from him. I was reading everything I could. I'm not a writer, but he said in a quote, I hope I'm getting it right, I write to find out what I think. And I just love that. And love stories about him giving, sometimes he'd give lesser companies as opposed to a big studio that wanted to do his film. I love that, what I read. I, of course, never met the man, but what a fabulous storyteller. And I've got more, but I get long-winded.
I want to
talk for me.
We will. I want to talk a little bit about Deadwood. You and Ian McShane, the only actors to appear in every episode of that series, by the very creative and interesting David Milch. Was it David Milch who gave you the nickname from Edgar Allan Poe, the Imp of the Perverse?
Yeah, based on a short story by Edgar Allan Poe. I thought it'd be a good title, but we have a title that the literary agent suggested, and I love it. But yes, and I think David's the Imp of the Perverse if you ever read about him, but the kind of person that will do the wrong thing because they know it's wrong. And when you sweetly said I was in every episode, sometimes I was barely in it, but I'm proud that I did survive it. And they have the script. They just called the agent about a two-hour movie this fall. And I hope I'm healthy, and I hope we've lost a couple of actors from the show. But David Milch is a genius type himself who taught English literature at Yale. And if you want an interesting bio, read about him. I love him because he gave me a great part.
And did that open doors, the HBO series, to True Blood for you?
I think so. It happened to be the same casting director. I don't know if I'd bore people by talking about that, but may I?
Please do. I don't think you could bore people with anything.
They said, come in and meet the great writer, another great writer, Academy Award-winning writer, Alan Ball, who did 6 Feet Under, and I think American Beauty won the Academy Award. But I read it. He said, well, try this, and I read it once more and was winging it. I said, well, speaking of bigots, none of them think they're bigots, and he kind of concurred. So when I left, I thought, well, I guess it went okay. But they did make me a series regular, although I didn't do all the shows. But sometimes got paid when I didn't do a show. So I just loved working with Alan Ball in the first few years. And then he moved to another show, and I did too.
Bill, would you say, as you look back at your career, have you been your own harshest critic?
Well, I'm probably, I hate to say, well, like some creative types or something that think they are. I'm never really satisfied, and I try to make a joke. I say low self-esteem is a step up. I stole that, but I beat myself up. Bob Newhart said you put too much pressure on yourself, and I don't know where it comes from. Again, the book, I talk about the childhood a little bit, but every actor and everybody in the world's had not the easiest life. But I am one grateful character actor, and I'm very happy.
And I've heard you mention the fact that you're very grateful, and much of this is what much of the book is going to be about. You're grateful for the second chances you've had.
Oh, my goodness. Yes, I guess David Milch intuitively knew some of the destructive things I did. I don't want it to sound like I'm bragging, but second chances, I call it providence and turn off half of Hollywood probably, but even my favorite country singer, Merle Haggard, said they're gifts. The songs that he wrote, the jobs that I get, the royalties, the Hulu, may I plug it, they just bought Newhart's new, our show. So that was part of the reason we went to the Paley Center in Beverly Hills and to celebrate that. And I don't know how much time I'm pitiful here since I wrote the book. I with a lot of help, I got on Instagram. We've had it 100 days since next week. It'll be 100 days. But it, may I say, if it's okay with you,
oh, what, please do.
What it is.
Absolutely.
It's called actor_William_Sanderson. And of course we have Facebook. I'm not in love with that, but that's what the publishers seem to like.
Yeah, and you've got a wonderful website too, and Carrie, our producer, mentioned the great gallery that's on there. Lots of terrific information.
Well, I thank you again. That's Nick from Tin Can Media, a podcaster who's helping us, and my wife, I sometimes sound like a pimp because I'm bragging on her so much, but none of it would have happened the last 30 years. I drank too much. When I met her, I knew that I couldn't We couldn't make it if I stopped, so I had to cut that out. But you know, it didn't stop me. I slowed down, but now with the book, I couldn't do it. I know I'm putting you to sleep.
Not at all.
And I did want to mention your website, williamsanderson.net. Circling back to the gallery, some great photos of you in different shows and different roles over the years, but the one that jumped out to me was the sketch, the image on there, the sketch that Daryl Hannah drew for you from the Blade Runner set. That was great to see.
Yeah, she was 19 years old and just a lovely, lovely woman. I think she is dating Neil Young right now, but lovely. And it's not for sale, but anyway, thank you for noticing. And there's Facebook, too. I thought you were talking about Facebook, and forgive me, that is helped by Nick from Tin Can Media podcast, Katsouris, if I'm pronouncing his last name. But I just sometimes say, why do they keep plugging themselves? Why do they keep plugging themselves? But I want the book to come out.
Yeah, we do too. We certainly hope that works out. We're looking forward to it. We have had a wonderful time talking with you, Bill. I hope you'll come back and talk with us some more because there's so much we didn't get to cover. You've worked with one of our good friends on the show, Stephen Tobolowsky. We wanted to talk about that and more. So we hope you'll come back.
He's a wonderful actor. I did a play with him and I did Deadwood with him, and I miss him. I'm back here in Pennsylvania momentarily, and give him my love if you get a chance.
We will do that, and we hope you'll join us again sometime.
Thank you, and Stephen, give him a hug for me.
That's actor William Sanderson here on The Best of Downtown. When we return, we'll talk with author Rachel Slade about her new book, Into the Raging Sea, right here on Z62 Retro Radio.
At Quirk Motor City, you get a huge selection of quality pre-owned vehicles priced to fit any budget. Plus, the Quirk Motor City pre-owned difference, with a limited warranty that's 3 times longer than the average dealer's pre-owned warranty. Free main state inspections for the life of the vehicle. A free Carfax vehicle history report. And Quirk Motor City's certified pre-owned 118-point inspection. It's your quality pre-owned car. Find it at Quirk Motor City in Bangor, Belfast, Augusta, and Portland. View our pre-owned inventory online at quirkauto.com.
Biking season is here, and the only way to be sure that you're road or trail ready is to bring your bike to Slipping Gears Cycling, Bangor's only full-time cycling sales and service experts at 753 Stillwater Avenue in Bangor before prime riding season slips away. Slipping Gears Cycling, 753 Stillwater Avenue in Bangor, Bangor's best full-service bike shop. Outstanding service, huge stock. Like them on Facebook for updates, shop in person, and online at slippinggears.com.
Since its founding in 1954, Cross Insurance has grown from a small family-owned agency that started in Bangor, Maine, into one of the largest super-regional insurance agencies in New England. With a network of offices throughout New England, Cross Insurance works with top carriers to provide maximum value to you, your family, and your business. We are proud to be the official insurance broker of the New England Patriots and would welcome the chance to provide security for your team. For more information, visit crossinsurance.com. Cross Insurance, where security meets strength.
Bennett Auto Center is the place to go for full-service auto care. From oil changes to engine jobs, they can handle your every need. Stop in at 24 Thatcher Street in Bangor and talk with the experienced local people at Bennett's. They offer great service, competitive prices on a wide range of tires, and best of all, people you can trust. Visit the website for more information at BennettAutoCenter.com. Give them a call at 947-0351 or drive on into Bennett Auto Center, 24 Thatcher Street, Bangor. A little more than 40 years ago, Gordon Lightfoot chronicled a terrible marine disaster, true story of the sinking of the Edmund Fitzgerald. Less than 3 years ago, the worst marine disaster since that took place with the sinking of the El Faro. And that's all chronicled in a very compelling new book by author Rachel Slade entitled Into the Raging Sea. We talked about the book with her earlier this week on Downtown. What drew you to the story of the El Faro?
Well, I really, really have been drawn to the sea since I was a little girl. I was born in Baltimore, raised in Philadelphia, lived in New York, now I'm in Boston. These are all port cities. And so I've always wanted to connect to the ocean in some way. And when I read about the sinking of El Faro, of course, like everybody, I wanted to know, what happened? How could we lose a modern ship in this day and age? But it also gave me an opportunity to connect with this incredible industry, the shipping industry in America.
Well, you've really done a remarkable job of weaving the story together. And one of the things that really brings the story to life are the voices of those people who were lost on the ship. Thanks to those black box recordings, how invaluable were they to you in telling this tale?
Unbelievable. So first I want to say that this is the longest black box recording in history. It was 26 hours of tape captured, audio captured on the bridge of that ship, leading up to the very final moments of the ship. But, you know, I started looking at this story before they recovered the black box. And so already I was drawn in by the people who are on the ship and the families who agreed to talk to me. So already I felt like I was starting to make a connection with those folks. But then when we got that transcript, that 500-page transcript, wow, I just felt like I was on the ship. It was incredible.
Well, and that's the feeling that you get as a reader as well. And there are certainly dramatic moments, but to me, maybe what's most chilling are those mundane conversations that take place on the ship when you know how it's all going to end.
Rich, that is such a good point. That's exactly right, because those are the moments when you realize that you might not have done anything different. Like, those are the moments when you can imagine your coworkers and friends being in that very same position and not being able to find their way out of it and just hoping for the best. Really, that's such a perceptive thing to say.
There were so many things working against the El Faro other than Joaquin, and it starts perhaps with the ship itself, which was quite outdated at the time of it taking off. Was it a 1974 ship?
That's correct, and it was actually designed in the 60s. So it's important to remember not just that this ship was, in order to keep it operational, they actually had to mill their own parts, create their own parts, and they also, you know, pulled parts off of scrap ships. But it's important to remember that the way that ship was built, the way it was designed, would never have been built today. We have changed our standards. We've changed our regulations. We could not have built that ship the way it was built today.
Also, the parent company, a tote, was at the very least ill-prepared. Communication systems, navigation systems certainly were not what they should have been.
I mean, that is definitely part of the story, and as all working men and women in America know, sometimes your company is looking out for you, and sometimes it's not. And in this case, there were many moments when, certainly when I was doing my research, when I felt that the shipping company could have done more to help out their mariners, certainly, you know, upgrading the systems, but very simply, just monitoring the ship. They were not tracking it. There was nobody on land that was tracking that ship and nobody on land that was tracking that storm from the shipping end of things. Although I do have to mention that there was a mariner, an off-duty mariner, Charlie Baird. He was the second mate of El Faro, and he was in South Portland. He was watching that storm develop, and he did reach out to Captain Davidson before they left dock Jacksonville.
We're talking with Rachel Slay, the author of Into the Raging Sea. You mentioned Captain Davidson, and there's certainly lots of questions about his experience, his ability to handle this situation. And while he's certainly one of the culprits in this story, in many ways, it's also maritime practice and regulation as well, and procedures that seem outdated given the technology that's available in so many walks of life.
That's true. I mean, you know, it's easy to pin all of this on Captain Davidson. And, you know, if you give a quick summary of what happened, it seems like it's all his fault, which is completely unfair. He's as much a victim of circumstance as all of us. I think that he was very concerned about his job security. He had, like all of us who work for a living, he had high expenses. And so he was, I think, very distracted by the pressures being put on him by the shipping company to get those goods through and to deliver things on time.
There are so many wonderful characters in this story. I was constantly drawn to Danielle Randolph, the second mate. She's such a sympathetic character. Did you find yourself in the telling of the story getting close to some of these people?
I mean, I adore Danielle. She was the second mate. She's from Rockland. She was the one of two women on the ship, but the only female officer on that ship. And yes, absolutely. I was really moved by her plight. She actually plotted a course that would have steered the ship to safety at 2 a.m, I believe. And, you know, it's not easy being a woman in a man's field, but it's also just not easy being a second mate. You know, this is a very hierarchical society, and she tried to convince the captain to change course, but she could not. But yes, many terrific, compelling characters. I mean, remember, sailors, they're storytellers, and when you talked about kind of the informal banter that we caught on tape, I mean, hearing them tell their stories is just wonderful and moving, but also terrifying.
I thought it was also fascinating to read of the search and rescue effort undertaken by the Coast Guard, trying so hard more than anything else to help the families get some closure. And I'm sure that's made it even tougher on the families of the 33 who went down.
When you don't have a body, it's extremely difficult to have closure. And Deb Roberts is up there in J, Maine. Probably a lot of your listeners are familiar with her because she has taken her grief and turned it into action. She's working very hard to advocate for mariners out on the water now. Her son actually, I think, just is about to graduate from Maine Maritime. But yes, it's very, very difficult when you've lost somebody, but you never have that closure when you lose somebody at sea. It's true.
You talked to so many family members. How important was it for them to make sure the story was told accurately?
Well, that's exactly the thing, and I hope that I did. I mean, how the families feel about this book and the reception to the book is extremely important to me. I think when I reached out to the folks who did agree to talk to me, they understood that what I wanted to do was humanize this tragedy. We could say 33 mariners, but they were 33 lives. They were 33 families. There were children. There were mothers. There were fathers who lost people on board. And so I felt that this book was also a tribute to those incredibly strong families that let their children or their spouses go to sea. They were out of communication, you know, 3 months sometimes at a time. They let them go, and then they lost them.
I thought it was very interesting, too, because you have an image in your mind of sailors, mariners, and who they are today, but there is no one description because you have people on the El Faro of so many different backgrounds, levels of education, job descriptions. It really is a cross-section.
You know, that's what's so interesting about American shipping and actually global shipping is that, especially El Faro, I found it's really a microcosm of American society. You're absolutely right. People of all different educational levels, all different, you know, socioeconomic levels, and from all up and down the East Coast. And they're all on this ship, which is out to sea. And so they only have each other. And it's just a really interesting society when you get on a working ship.
It seems hard to believe with all the technology that we have that a tragedy of this magnitude could happen. But the reality is that there are financial constraints, not just on companies and shipping companies, but on the government, on the National Transportation Safety Board as well. What have we learned from the sinking of the El Faro that might lessen the chance of something like this happening again?
Well, so the U.S. government, the federal government, spent millions of dollars first locating the ship because we could not find it 15,000 feet on the ocean floor. We had to actually first locate that ship. And then we had to recover the black box, which took more time. There was a 2-year investigation, as you mentioned, jointly run by the National Transportation Safety Board and the Coast Guard. Out of those investigations and hearings came a series of recommendations. As you know, the wheels of law turns slow in America. Sometimes that's good, sometimes that's bad, but it takes a long time for things to evolve and change in shipping. What I hope is that with this story, mariners and regulators and anybody involved with shipping can transform their thinking just a little bit to prevent something like this from happening again.
Rachel, you did a remarkable job in this, and I don't know that I can say this about many books, of evoking not just the feel, but the sound. I was struck by the sound that you're able to tell us about in words, from the sound of the storm to that awful sound of the ship hitting the bottom of the ocean. And it really helped put us there and get some kind of a feel for what it must have been like.
Well, I do love being on the water. I love sailing, and, you know, I've been in storms. I actually took a container ship from Italy to Baltimore, Maryland last summer. So I know ships a little bit. I've worked really hard to try to understand what it's like, of course, to be on a ship, but even in a storm. Now, I did my best. There are some incredible YouTube videos as well of ships in storms. Some of them I found out later actually cracked in half after the guys filmed those incredible moments of ships in storms. But thank you very much for the compliment. I mean, I did work very hard to try to be true to the mariners and their experience.
Well, and the story, too, that you relate about getting from, is it the pilot boat, the captain boat, up onto the ship, that was harrowing enough right there.
Yes, it was. I didn't quite know what I was getting in for there. So also to reach the ship, this story, I had the privilege of riding piloting boats with Eric Bryson down in Florida. He was the last person on El Faro. He took El Faro from Jacksonville out to sea for her final run. So being able to do that exact run with the very same pilot was a powerful, powerful thing. And yes, I have to say, to board a ship at sea as a pilot, anybody who doesn't know this, please look it up because the YouTube videos are so harrowing. But this little boat pulls up alongside the ship and a rope ladder comes down. When was the last time you had to climb a rope ladder? And then here, there's nothing below you. If you fall, you fall between the two vessels, you get sucked under, it's over. And plenty of pilots have died that way.
It is a remarkable book, Into the Raging Sea, 33 Mariners, One Megastorm, and the Sinking of El Faro. Rachel Slade, thank you so much for being with us this afternoon.
Rich, it's been such a pleasure. Thank you.
Author Rachel Slade, great book is called Into the Raging Sea. It's the best of downtown on your Sunday morning. When we return, we talk with Mark Duplass about his new book, Like Brothers, and the many other activities he's got going on. Another season of Room 104 on HBO. And, of course, the new movie Tully with Charlize Theron. It's all next on the best of downtown.
Go Blue!
Sir, you're here for the cheerleading tryouts?
Yeah, for the class of 82. Gotta show my school spirit.
I know a better way. The UMaine Alumni Signature Rewards Visa Card from University Credit Union. Low rates, no annual fees, and it earns reward points for travel, merchandise, or cash back.
Woo, sounds easier than a backflip.
Apply online today at UMaineAlumniCard.com.
Federally insured by NCUA. Terms and conditions apply, subject to credit approval.
At this busy time of year, there's nothing better than a place that offers you one-stop shopping. That place is G&M Family Market on the corner of Route 1A and Route 46 in Holden. Fresh produce delivered daily, a great selection of meats and seafood, beer and wine, of course, a Dunkin' Donuts and an Amato's right on site. Stop into G&M Family Market every day of the week from 6 in the morning till 9 o'clock at night, and if they don't have what you're looking for, they'll make every effort to get it next time. G&M Family Market, Route 1A and Route 46 in Holden.
Green Acres Kennel Shop in Bangor will once again host free education events for pet parents this May. Join Don Hansen, co-owner of Green Acres Kennel Shop, for Why Shock Collars Can Be Harmful to Our Dogs and Humane Alternatives to Electrical Shock. This free seminar will be held on Tuesday, May 8th at 6:30 p.m. and Saturday, May 12th at 2:30 p.m. Don is a certified dog behavior consultant and a certified professional dog trainer. He will review the scientific, peer-reviewed literature on shock as well as recommendations on humane and effective alternatives to electric shock collars. On Saturday, May 19th at 10 a.m., Green Acres Kennel Shop will present Dog Behavior, Body Language, and Dog Parks with Don Hansen. In this free seminar, Don will address what you need to know about canine behavior and canine body language to make sure your visit is safe and fun for all. Learn more about these free educational events at the Green Acres Kennel Shop Facebook page.
We love Green Acres Kennel Shop, our home away from home.
Back on the Best of Downtown, two of the busiest guys in Hollywood who have known each other for quite a while. Well, they grew up together, often in the same bedroom. Mark and Jay Duplass have become very successful as indie movie and television writers, producers, directors, and actors. They write about that relationship, the unique one that it is, in the new book, Like Brothers. And we had a chance to talk about that and more with Mark Duplass earlier this week on Downtown. Well, my goodness, everybody is raving about the book, Like Brothers. You wrote it with Jay Duplass. How long have you known your co-writer?
It's been about 41 years, or more or less. It is my lifelong collaboration, for better or for worse.
Yeah, and you guys write about your growing up period and what got you into making films and telling stories together, and then a lot about the creative process. Was it you were 7 and Jay was 11 when your dad brought a video camera into the house?
Yeah, I think, you know, like most dads in the 80s, he didn't really know how to use the electronics, so he just let us figure it out. And I think we got the early starts of filmmaking then. And I think you can look at some filmmakers like the Coen brothers or Steven Spielberg, and in their early films, you can really see the geniuses they would become. That was not the case at all with our movies, which were all horrific for the next 20 years. But eventually, somewhere in our late 20s, we kind of figured out if we started making fun of ourselves on camera, people tended to like that. So we made a career out of it.
Now, our producer, Carrie, is shopping for a house in New Orleans right now. He can't get out of here and get there fast enough. How did growing up in New Orleans help shape you guys and nurture your creativity?
Well, you know, we grew up in the suburbs, and what was great about that is we were kind of free to roam and figure out the artists we wanted to be, you know. And needless to say, it's a very culturally rich city. But I would say more our time in Austin, Texas, in the mid-90s, when guys like Richard Linklater were really paving the way for independent film, you know, just regular guys with bad jeans and bad haircuts, of moderate intelligence and moderate looks were being successful. And that really made us feel like, whoa, if some genetic B minuses like us can make it, then, you know, this is really an exciting time.
Well, what are the things you guys have learned in this journey through the years that can be useful to other people working their way up and hoping to find whether it's a career in film or in television or anything creative?
Yeah, I think that, you know, when we started writing this book, we really felt like, you know, like everybody has 500 movies on their Netflix queue and TV shows, and they got 100 books they want to read. So if we're going to do this, we should try to make it semi-useful. And I think that, you know, the one thing we do know quite a bit about is how to come from nowhere with no connections and push that boulder up the mountain and turn it into something. And this book is a detailed account of how we did that in the film business, but it could really apply to any other independent artist or even startup trade, because it's really at its core about why, at least in our experience, it was so important to collaborate closely with someone you love to help you in that sort of really just indefatigable journey of trying to become a success in a world where we knew nothing about it. I mean, Hollywood was just was Mars to us, and we had to figure it out on our own.
Now, not every brother or even sister combination works out. You know, there are horror stories about the Everly brothers barely speaking to each other, breaking up on stage. Why have you two been able to work so closely and make it work personally as well?
I think we had to write a book to try and figure that out, and I still don't think we've figured it out. You know, some of it has to do with you know, the feeling of being overwhelmed by trying to you know, trying to become successful in an industry that's so competitive. We felt we needed each other. Part of it is, I think, is the way that we were raised. You know, I mean, my parents just taught us to be sort of kind and respectful and speak nicely to each other. And you know, I think one thing that's been interesting about this book is, you know, Jay and I are actually quite different people, but we've been able to put our differences aside for the greater good of staying together and trying to make something useful. So in that way, I think the book is kind of a larger think piece about collaboration and learning how to get along in a time when, you know, we are seeing massive personality and differences in people in our families, you know. So it was really fun to kind of to kind of show how we made it work and see if we could find a connection point for other people.
But you've walked that walk in the world as well, and we talked about it last time you were on. You've reached out to people on the opposite side politically and tried to find common ground with them and try to avoid the name-calling. And certainly it looks like the most success you've had with that has been in doing good deeds. You recently raised enough money to start a library in Nepal. And is it on that area that right and left can come together and do some good?
That's what I'm currently finding is the lowest common denominator of connection. I mean, things are pretty raw right now. So rather than open political conversations, my feeling is like, all right, I think one thing we can all agree on is starving and needy children need places to sleep and books and education and healthcare. And that's been a very easy thing. So, you know, I've been lucky enough to partner with people, you know, like Glenn Beck, who I could not disagree with more politically, quite frankly, but I just find to be a really generous person who likes to take care of people who need help. And so that's where we're trying to start. I mean, we're not like changing the world or anything, but we're doing little things, and it's been nice.
We're talking with Mark Duplass here on Downtown. The book is called Like Brothers, also opening today all over the country, a brand new movie. My goodness, talk about talented people assembling. Jason Reitman, Diablo Cody, Charlize Theron, you, Ron Livingston. Tell us about Tully.
Yeah, Tully is really an essential movie about motherhood. And, you know, there's a lot of tales about how gorgeous and rewarding it can be. But this is the other side when it can really crush you. And Charlize was just amazing. You know, she really dove into this thing, and she put on 50 pounds for the role to tell the story of a woman who has a third child that maybe she didn't really want, and how is she going to deal with that and find herself in that? So it's dark comedy, and it's a really beautiful movie.
You and Jay have also produced a wonderful documentary series on Netflix. I loved Wild Wild Country, and now coming out in just, I think, a week from today, Evil Genius, which looks tremendous as well.
Yeah, we've always been fans of documentaries, but quite frankly, I've been sort of fearful to make them because they takes so long to get them right, but we've been able to partner with some younger filmmakers, which is a lot of what we've been doing lately, and make these two series, and they're really, really exciting. I think Wild Wild Country in particular is one of the things I'm most proud of we've made in the past few years.
How beneficial is it to do a documentary on a platform like Netflix where you can take the time to tell the story and you're not trying to fit the story into a specific slot?
Yeah, I mean, Netflix has been a seminal partner for us. Ted Sarandos, who runs that company, bought our first tiny little movie, The Puffy Chair, which we shot in Down East Maine, and we shot in Bangor House, right on French Street, right across from the park there, where, you know, my sister-in-law Mary Budd lives, and they bought that movie from us, and I've maintained a close relationship with them, and they have grown exponentially, and they have still kept us in the family, and we're really, really lucky to have them as a partner, because, you know, they drop a movie and it goes into 180 countries, and to get those kinds of eyeballs today is just, you know, it's very unique.
One of your upcoming collaborations with Netflix, I believe, is a film you're doing with Ray Romano.
Yeah, we do a series of original films for Netflix, and I can't say too much about it. We haven't leaked the plot yet, but it's kind of an ultimate buddy movie with me and Ray Romano. And Jay and I are always obsessed with the sort of male intimacy. That's a big topic in Like Brothers, and it's also a topic in the movie we wanted to make with Ray.
I also love the first season of Room 104 on HBO. It's such a great anthology series, a throwback to the stuff I grew up on or wish I'd grown up on, like Alfred Hitchcock Presents and The Twilight Zone. I exposed some new directors to their opportunities, and you're already working on the second season, is that right?
Yeah, we're working on the second and the third season simultaneously, and fun fact is Lauren Budd, who is a Bangor native, at 19 years old was interning at our company and wrote a script that was so good that we produced it for the second season. So she's one of the youngest female writers to ever have an episode of TV produced. And also with our book, she was very helpful in editing the book with me. And her mother, Mary, who's I was referencing, my sister-in-law, when she was staying at our house, we were trying to figure out what the title of the book was going to be. And she wrote it down on a sticky note and left it on my kitchen counter, and that ended up being the title of the book. So a lot of deep Bangor connections on this one.
No question about it. And you guys have paved new ground, too. Not many books have had a trailer before.
Yeah, they said, "Do you want to make a trailer for your book?" And we said, "What the hell is that? I don't know what that means." And they said, "Just think of a movie trailer and come up with something for your book." And I mean, we're so busy right now. We had zero time. So Jay and I met at the office and we just said, "Look, we'll set aside 2 hours and we'll figure it out." And that was actually really fun because we shot it all on our iPhones, just the two of us. And it felt again like we were, you know, 7 and 11 years old, kind of running around with our dad's video camera, which is an energy as our company grows, we're continually trying to tap into to grow ourselves, to offer opportunities to younger filmmakers, to do what we can, but at the same time, like, try not to lose a little bit of that, like, childlike fun that is where we built this thing from in the first place.
The book is called Like Brothers by Mark and Jay Duplass, and obviously it's to learn about you and to talk about your childhood, the process, to share what's worked for you as filmmakers and as creative people. What did you learn about yourselves in the writing of the book?
I think the interesting thing that happened while we were writing this book is that we were making a TV show called Togetherness for HBO, and it got canceled. And that was when Jay and I were at the height of our collaboration, spending 13 hours a day together, best friends, brothers, business partners. And when that show went away, for the first time, we started to question, do we have to be as close as we are now? Is it possible we could find some personal space? And what we thought was going to be a book that was essentially a treatise on the powers of collaboration turned into a larger question about all the greatness we've got out of, but some of the individuality that we have lost in our own personal self. So it was fun to write, but it was a little bit painful at times too. So like our movies, I guess it's funny, but it's got its bittersweet moments too.
Well, you mentioned Togetherness, and I've told you this before. That was such a tremendous series. I was so sad to see it go away after two seasons, but I feel like that's one of those series, much like something like Freaks and Geeks, that people are going to discover if they didn't see it the first time around and say, this is incredible writing and acting. How did this not last a decade? Although it probably would have killed you if it did.
I think it would have, or even worse, maybe I would have kept making it because the money would have been so good, and it would have just started to get really, really bad and stale and creatively lame. So maybe it's better they killed us while we were at the top of our game.
That's Mark Duplass talking about the new book, Like Brothers, here on The Best of Downtown, your Sunday morning. When we come back, we visit with a funny guy, actor and comedian Jay Moore, next on Z62 Retro Radio.
When it comes to your health, early detection is the best protection. That's why the St. Joseph Regional Breast Care Center provides 3D mammography to offer better answers and greater peace of mind, identifying problem areas that a standard mammogram might miss. It provides precise images for all women, including those with dense breast tissue. Call 907-1682 to schedule your 3D mammogram at the St. Joseph Regional Breast Care Center. 3D, providing peace of mind for you, your family, and your loved ones.
Since its founding in 1954, Cross Insurance has grown from a small family-owned agency that started in Bangor, Maine, into one of the largest super-regional insurance agencies in New England. With a network of offices throughout New England, Cross Insurance works with top carriers to provide maximum value to you, your family, and your business. We are proud to be the official insurance broker of the New England Patriots and would welcome the chance to provide security for your team. For more information, visit crossinsurance.com. Cross Insurance, where security meets strength.
Angelo's Pizzeria has locations in both Bangor and in Hamden, and they're your home for the best pizza, homemade pasta, and Italian takeout. Angelo's Pizzeria, located on Hammond Street in Bangor and Main Road South in Hamden, features a menu that also includes seafood, sandwiches, wraps, and salads. That means there's sure to be something for every member of the family. Stop into Angelo's Pizzeria, Hammond Street, Bangor, Main Road South in Hamden.
Spring's the time for everything new, fresh, innovative. Time for the brand new, all redesigned Ram 1500 at Hartley's.
The 2019 Ram 1500 is awesome. With more everything, more storage,
more performance,
more technology,
more efficiency,
and more leather.
In the new Ram 1500, there's safety all around you. It's the strongest Ram ever. Capable, built to serve,
rugged,
and refined.
Start your own rebellion. Get yourself a Ram 1500 at Hartley's.
Don't miss the 2018 Jeep Wrangler, an all-new version evolution of a true icon at Hartley's.
Diesel power, hybridization, and full-wheel, all-wheel drive are options. Wrangler is legendary for sport, fun, and work. The incredible 2018 is the most accommodating and comfortable Wrangler yet.
The new Ram 1500 and the all-new 2018 design Jeep Wrangler. Check them out at Hartley's.
The best deals on new Ram 1500s and 2019 Jeep Wranglers aren't in the city, they're in the country. Hartley's Country in Newport. Hartley'sCountry.com.
Thinking of making home improvements to increase efficiency? Well, there's no time like the present. And the people at Penobscot Home Performance want you to know that efficiency main rebates have increased from $700 to $1,000 per zone as of May 1st. Also, anyone with Bangor Gas can get rebates for $2,000 per insulation zone up to $5,000. Call to get your free home energy audit at 469-6100 or visit PenobscotHomePerformance.com. Hey, it's the Best of Downtown, your Sunday morning, brought to you by Quirk Motor City Used Vehicle Center. Locations in Augusta, Bangor, Belfast, and Portland. It's your car. Find it at QuirkAuto.com. Jay Moore is a very funny guy. You know him from his stand-up comedy work, TV, movie appearances. He's got a terrific podcast, Moore Stories, and a very good website as well. He'll be coming to Maine for two shows end of the month, May 26th at Aura in Portland, and the 27th at the Criterion in Bar Harbor. We had a chance to visit with him this week on Downtown.
How you guys doing? That's quite an intro. I got a lot to live up to here.
Yeah, we set the bar pretty high for you there, but I mean, you've done it. You got your hands in everything through the years. We thought, though, since you know sports awfully well, maybe you can help us out and make sense of this this recent NFL draft. Who do you think down the road ends up being the talk of that draft, the steal of the draft?
You know what? I really like the Patriots pick, Isaiah Wynn. He was listed as a guard for some reason, but his left tackle at Georgia against Alabama, nobody got through on that side at all. And he impressed me, and those were big games. I mean, that's against the Crimson Tide. So I like that pick a lot. I love the wide receiver, Christian Kirk. I was talking to Herman Edwards once, and I said, this guy always catches passes in traffic. Herman Edwards goes, let me ask you a question. Why is he always in traffic? Christian Kirk is never in traffic. When he catches the ball on tape, no, he drives at night only. No one's near him. So that's a good guy. But, yeah, I don't have a sports podcast. I don't know. I'm sorry you wasted your time.
No.
We talk sports often, but not at the risk of losing, like, you know, non-sports fans. But I'm always down to talk some sports, man.
Well, and you get great guests on the podcast, and I love it. And they were on again recently. I love it when you have the Sklar brothers on. You guys work so well together.
Oh. Man, that was some serious nonsense. I told my girlfriend, I said, if you want to know what it's like in a car with three comedians, listen to the Sklar brothers, Randy and Jason, and me. Because I don't know. If somebody wants to tweet me or email me at morestories3737@gmail.com and actually have bullet points of everything we spoke about, I'll send them a free shirt because I have no idea what happened. It was like being on acid.
You did the talk show.
We're talking about barefoot, like wrestlers and WWE, like check their feet for foreign objects, like how you check boots. Like the guy's barefoot. Yeah, that was madness. Thank you.
That was great. Did you enjoy doing the talk show on Fox? That's a huge commitment to do a show every day, though.
I loved it. It's a different. It's for radio people. And I'm not a radio person. I'm more, you know, I am a comedian. I am definitely a comedian. And that job was a great place where I could introduce a new way of doing sports talk radio comedically and be a feminist on the radio and not be left or right, just have common sense and no negativity, positivity only. And but that daily thing that you speak of, that's really hard. It was about 3.5 years. And the reason you're a comedian is you get bored over there, you get on an airplane, you go somewhere else. You do a movie for a month, you're done, you go over there. You do a podcast, you do it once a week, you do it twice a week. It's a grind, for sure. And it really made me appreciate how talented, like, Colin Cowherd is, and, you know, Max, and, you know, all the guys. And Patrick, these guys are exceptional for a reason.
You think of yourself as a comedian first, and does anything that you do, of all of the various things that you do in your life, does anything give you that feedback, that energy that you get from going on a stage and doing comedy?
No, I don't think it's possible either, because it's an immediate validation. I mean, if you think about it this way, like I'm an AA, you know, I'm very open about my recovery and my podcast, More Stories. The most manly thing you can do is ask for help, ever. Now, I'm just only saying that because we're on the radio and I'm not going to miss an opportunity to let a guy know that. So I'm a validation. I can make anything an addiction. Like, I'm a validation addict. I need validation that's it's irrational. I get applause on my way to work. When I walk to the stage, they're clapping. Like, if you walk down the hallways of the radio station, people are like, oh my God, yeah, let's do it. They're playing music and everybody's clapping. And then I go on stage, and for 90 minutes, I go again and again and again. And then I get off stage, and I go to Twitter to see how I did. It's nothing could top stand-up comedy. Nothing. I mean, but it's also who I am. I was born a comedian, period. I know that in my bones. I'm very lucky to act and meet. This isn't particularly funny by me. I feel like I'm doing a TED Talk. So you should do Tracy Morgan, get Maine pregnant. Yeah. I got brand new wheelchair gloves. I went to Portuguese girl. She made me meatballs. Yeah. Sorry, I got too serious for my own good. I had to break into some nonsense.
Jay Moore with us. He'll be at Aura in Portland on May 26th, the Criterion in Bar Harbor on May 27th. This new world of television in the last few years with so many outlets, Netflix and others, I'm going to say this. This is a bold statement. I thought your show Action was so far ahead of its time that if that thing were on the air today, that would be a huge hit on a Netflix or an Amazon Prime. I thought that was a great show.
Let me tell you something. I'm able to put modesty aside and tell you, you're right, and thank you, and you're obviously one of the cool kids, because that show was crazy good. I got to go to work with Buddy Hackett every day. And I remember one day in between takes on Action, we only did 8 episodes, bro. 8. That's it. And one day on set, he goes, you want to know the secret to show business? I'll tell you at lunch. I go, okay. And like lunch, he goes, don't forget to come see me at lunch. I'm going to tell you the secret to show business. I go, all right. So lunchtime comes around. He goes, but I don't eat where everybody eats. I like to eat alone in my trailer, so come to my trailer. So I get my food. I eat it. I go to Buddy Hackett's trailer. He goes, come in. He was in a suit. I don't know, in 4 minutes, he's in a bathrobe. He's holding a thing of tequila, and he goes, have a seat, pal. You want to know the secret to the whole show business? Have a seat. I sit down, and he goes, now, here it is. Oh, to be a Nagasaki where the women shoot the back and the men say, whoa, whoa. That's it. You got to go now. I get to the door. He goes, also, Elton John, gay.
Wow, breaking ground. Now, I don't want you to have to get serious again, Jay, but you've got some really wonderful poems on your website, and some of them are incredibly poignant. I was reading the one, I remember being born the day I met you. I was tearing up reading that thing. It was great.
Thank you, brother. That's poetry is new to me. When I went through my divorce, I was pretty broken up, and I just started writing poems. I've always enjoyed writing stuff, but I didn't really have a specific place, you know, to, it wasn't like a short story, it wasn't a script, it wasn't a poem. And so I started writing poetry, and then the one you just mentioned is about when my mom got sober. I was 11, I believe, I might have fudged it a little in the poem, but 1980, she came home the day after Christmas, and we didn't open our presents, and they just seemed ridiculous the day after Christmas, because mom was home, the war's over, you know? So I that really means, man, that's, you hit me, man. You hit me good, in a good way. It's beautiful. The fact that you said that really means the world to me, because they're important to me, and I wouldn't release them unless I knew that they were, you know, damn good, and I know they are. And, yeah, I'll get them in a book, and they'll be out one day, but you can go to jaymoore.com and read a bunch of them, and on Periscope, it's usually when I do them.
Actor and comedian Jay Moore on The Best of Downtown. Thanks to Jay, Mark Duplass, author Rachel Slade, and actor William Sanderson for joining us and being part of your Sunday morning. And thanks to you for being there as well. Don't forget to check in with us tomorrow on the show as we kick off the week. with Mike Lowe, the Portland Press Herald, Alan Adams of the Maine Edge, Maine baseball coach Nick Durba, and a whole lot more. And good stuff all week long on Downtown. Harry, enjoy your Sunday. Big plans today?
No big plans, just enjoying what is supposed to be a great weekend.
I hope so. Yeah, we'll keep our fingers crossed there, and we'll do our thing tomorrow afternoon. Thanks for joining us Downtown right here, Z62 Retro Radio. You're gonna be